Miller, the normal interlocutor of this show, is in the cool high mountains of Colorado. Lucky for him, because it's hot here. But we're going to try and fill in and do the Weekly Times podcast. You know, Benji, I think that from a strictly human point of view, the biggest thing that happened this week revolved around Preferred Family Healthcare, the mental health services provider that has been enmeshed in the scandal over kickbacks between some of its officials and legislators, which now the state's late last week suspended it as a participant in Medicaid at some point in the future.
Right.
And now it looks like it may pull out of the state.
Right, yeah. So
I want to say, I'm acutely aware that there are people who receive services that will be affected by this, and what, 700 employees who certainly will be affected. And I'm not sure that this story has necessarily reached broad public significance.
Right. Yeah, though it's such an enormous amount of money. It's such an enormous, area of the state affected, especially in areas where they're the only provider or one of the only providers in town. You know, I think the impact of this really varies from town to town. I was speaking to somebody in Northeast Arkansas who is a former employee of Preferred Family Healthcare, and this person keeps up with folks who are still employed there. And in the community in question, there's other providers, you know, so there may be places where the impact is relatively minimal if there are other places that can absorb those patients, even though, you know, with behavioral health, you know, with substance abuse treatment and dealing with people with mental illness, you know, there's a real rapport built up between the therapist and a patient. It's not like a primary care physician where you could just transfer care over to somebody else.
Now, we've heard from some clinicians who are just really upset about this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's deeply upsetting, especially when you have people in this fragile mental state that could, you know, a big disruption in their lives. Who knows what sort of tangent that could send them on.
I don't want to shirk away from my big mouth. I have long ago reached a position, while I am acutely aware of the human cost here, that the amount of corruption that surrounded this operation, and it got a billing scheme, I think you know about, that was advantageous to it through the legislature, that it shouldn't be able to profit off that from all the illegal action that has now been verified in federal court cases.
Right. I mean, the hard thing here is to disentangle, the actual provision of services from this fraudulent behavior, which was absolutely taking place.
And right, I'm not accusing anybody still there of illegal actions, although we know we found at least one person they decided to suspend after the fact, after we inquired about it. But I'm saying they found themselves in a most favored position because of some illegal actions, and something, it seemed to me, needed to be done. I wonder why the state finally moved.
Well, I mean, the announcement that they put out last Friday indicated that Medicaid fraud was just sort of a different animal to DHS's perspective.
Right, they charge a new person.
Yeah, and it's just the nature of the scheme. You know, like, rather than Robin Ravindran, the man who was charged last week, wasn't accused of bribing legislators. He was accused of actually defrauding the Medicaid program.
Well, yeah, with bogus claims. And a scheme to figure out a way to file bogus claims.
Correct. And that sort of initiated this, from the state's perspective, at least they framed it as like, well, this triggers a suspension.
Although, didn't we learn in this, and we've since learned that perhaps some other agencies might have fallen into this too, that this law sort of encouraged you to really press the envelope on billing. And that people might have been employed in a way that's sort of like a traffic cop writing speeding tickets. They were rewarded for how often they reimbursed. And doesn't that encourage fraudulent activity?
Well, you know, from my perspective, one of the things about this, it's like, so I don't really know, honestly, because there's a lot we don't understand
about the ins and outs here.
It seems like an especially egregious example of that, but this is endemic to the entire healthcare system.
This was a $43 million operation, but that is huge. And we know that there are now felony admissions of some $6 million worth of bribery and illegal expenditures, which suggests they had a pretty good profit margin in their money.
Yeah.
But this is only, I don't know how big the Medicaid program is overall. Billions, several billion dollars, I think.
Oh, in Arkansas alone, yeah. Yes.
When you count nursing homes and hospitals and everything else, and so I do think it's, to me, it was always worth noting that the Attorney General has a Medicaid fraud division, We have a Medicaid Inspector General, and they've turned up some things here and there, but nothing approaching this. And this grew out of the federal investigation of public corruption, of bribery. And, you know, you just have the feeling that there's a lot more of this out there. That's based on nothing, but money is tempting.
Right. And I think, I mean, the Medicaid system, like really all healthcare is sort of ripe for exploitation in a way, because the linkage between the product that you're delivering and the person paying it can be so opaque and convoluted. You know, earlier this year, we had this whole thing with pharmacy benefit managers in the state.
Oh, right,
this,
right.
This incomprehensible thicket of like, of payments between drug companies and intermediary companies and drug suppliers and pharmacists. And it's just when you have all of this complexity, it just creates all these opportunities for people that know the system well to extract.
And that reminds me, one of our latest controversy is whether we should use a computer or a real human being to decide what's the proper amount of care paid for by Medicaid for people who are disabled and living at home rather than in an institution.
Sure, yeah, the AR Choices Program, you know, which is yet another corner of the Medicaid system. And you know, the state will say, well, we implemented this algorithm in an attempt to make it, you know, more objective and less, like, subject to whatever.
To spend less money is what they really mean. And speaking of that and Medicaid, today, Friday, when we're taping this, was the deadline for the first reporting by the first group of people under the new Medicaid work rule, that in which you've got to figure out how to get online and tell the state that you're doing your 80 hours of work so you can still qualify for Medicaid coverage under the Arkansas Works Program.
Sure, right. So
is this going to be a cluster?
Well, it already seems to be, but people haven't started losing their insurance yet, so it still is. It hasn't really penetrated a lot of people's consciousness.
Well, the Democrat Gazette this week checked early in the week, and at that point, I guess there are 11,000 people who weren't automatically exempt and thus seemed to be required to fill out something with the state online, and only right. 3,000 had at that point. We haven't had an update since the 9 p.m. deadline Thursday night.
Yeah, and you know, the state is rolling this out in phases, so eventually there will be something like, I think, 70,000-ish people who would be subject to the requirement once it's fully in place in 2019. But as of the end of this month, it's 11,000 people. Another like 11, 12,000 be rolled into it next month. And yeah, only a small minority of those.
And you have to fail to do the amount of work 3 months before you're thrown off the program.
Three non-consecutive months in a single calendar year would get you locked out of the program for the remainder of that year. Right.
And so it's going to take a while before it happens. But
not till, I guess, September.
It occurs to me that late in the year, if it does turn out that 30 or 40,000 people end up being put off the program, some might say, well, good.
Well, sure.
Absolutely. Maybe they learned how to use a computer. Maybe they got jobs. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they're not energetic enough to deserve to be covered, whatever. But it occurs to me that then we get the other element of the hospitals and nursing homes or health services agencies and insurance companies that aren't getting that money anymore. And then that might be an ancillary problem.
Right. Well, it's this odd, it's such an odd thing. And like, I remain like not totally convinced about DHS's like, I think their motivation is just sort of, it's this contradictory thing where it's partly motivated by a desire to shrink the roles, and it's partly motivated by just a desire to show that you're doing something.
Right. I'm willing to say they're not, that Asa Hutchinson's goal isn't necessarily to shrink the roles.
I'm not sure anybody knows what
that is. Well, I think the goal was politically is that there is a very strong feeling against people receiving something for nothing, they think. I mean,
sure.
and that government alms to poor people are just not justified. And so to reach out to them, they created a work rule that said, okay, if you work, then you get something in return for working. And I think that was sort of the appeal of that. And if there's a side benefit, they spend less money. Well, that, of course, to the people who hate spending anything, that's good.
But this is the odd thing. Like the argument from DHS has been all along, well, not that many people are going to lose coverage. You shouldn't really worry about that. And part of the reason why, they say, is because you have this unique system of the private option in which the insurance carriers are providing the coverage for a lot of people. So the carriers have this incentive to make contact with those members and to try to remind them to, you know, fulfill the work requirement and so on. So,
but number one, you're talking about a poor population that's highly transient. Some of them are homeless at times. They move a lot because they get evicted. And they, I mean, I've seen this in Little Rock School District and the poor population there. Tracking kids from home to home is right. sometimes an impossible task. So then the insurance and your phones. I mean, your phone, if you, nobody has landlines anymore. They go through multiple cheap phones. So there's finding those people is hard. And then leading them to the computer website, which is the only place to stay eligible right. in a state that has the second lowest computer user ratio in the country, it just seems nuts to me.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's just, I think the more transient people are, the more sort of, like, less they have their shit together in a way in their life in general, the more likely it is that they're going to lose coverage. And it's like people that are...
I mean, this is an at-risk population to begin with.
Correct, yeah.
And you know, Kentucky sued, or people sued in Kentucky, and they, over their work waiver, which some people try and tell me is a great deal different from Arkansas, but it seems to me at its core, the essential thing is setting a rule on Medicaid that likely will reduce Medicaid availability, which runs contrary to the spirit of the legislation, for sure.
Sure, right. And I think, you know, we'll see what Matt Bevin, the governor of Kentucky, is going to do about that.
He says he'll throw him off dental and eye care. And of course, that. He probably can do that because that was a new service.
Uh-huh.
See, there's a great precedent in Arkansas through the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeal where some legislators long ago started a Medicaid program, therapeutic daycare, wonderful idea, but then it grew exponentially. It became very expensive. And the state tried to put a limit on it and cut it back. The Eighth Circuit said, no, once you provide a Medicaid service, you don't have to start it. But once you started it, you can't just take it away. And so that may yet come into play in the courts in Arkansas. I don't know, but that is background history anyway.
Yeah, but we do not have a lawsuit yet.
No, and I still think it's a possibility here, but there's so many other things happening. Well, let's switch to another favorite topic. There's been a lot of school news. I think one thing I wrote about today, my pet peeve, which is the State Board of Education next week is going to put in place what the legislature mandated in 2017, which is further restrictions on the school choice law, the school transfer law, in which basically, it's just about impossible for a school district to opt out of the mandatory transfer law, which allows people to go through this, unless you can produce a court ruling that specifically prohibits these kind of transfers, you're not going to be able to do it. The thing that I found interesting is that the legislature also said, we don't want anybody counting anymore the number of transfers and what the races of transfers are, because they know that it illustrates clearly that these transfers are generally for racial purposes, white students fleeing majority black districts. So that's my rant about that. School scores came out for the ACT Aspire test, grades 3 through 10, and the 11th grade taking the ACT test. The state news release did a pretty masterful job of trying to cover up the news, which was scores didn't improve much. In fact, they declined in a lot of cases. Now, I know you perhaps can tell us there have been some changes in testing, and so we're getting used to new benchmarks.
Well, yeah, I'm not actually. I'd have to go back and look at how that happened. There were basically 3 years in a row in which the state had a new standardized test, and this... I was just thinking about this the other day about how long it's been since I've heard the words Common Core. You know, remember 3 years ago when that was going to be the apocalypse whenever they introduced these Common Core standards. And so, I mean, yeah, there was the old Arkansas benchmark test, and then they had, I forget what the national consortium was that had the...
Right.
And then the ACT Aspire. But the problem with that is, like, you can kind of finesse the scores to track... to compare school to school, like did this district or this campus underperform relative to others? But when you have, you know, when you're switching from one test to another, you just can't compare year to year. So it makes it really hard to track chronologically.
Although also, I mean, I noted today that the paid school choice advocate from the Waltons was talking, first of all, about how the state scores generally weren't very good, and particularly they were bad in the Little Rock District. And, of course, my first objection to that is comparing the Little Rock District to the state as a whole is kind of apples and oranges, because there's a great difference in demographic makeup of the state versus the school district. There are more minorities in the Little Rock District, more poor kids, and unfortunately they tend to have lower scores. But I think it seems to me that what scores illustrate is that income will out. I mean, middle class kids do okay, and poor kids, we just haven't figured out a way to reach them. And that's in the regular public schools, that's in the charter schools. I mean, there's some outliers who do a little bit better here and there, some individual places, but overall, it's just, it seems to me, I saw this guy, this lobbyist, Gary Newton, say, well, it's just a matter of we get a good teacher to teach reading and a good teacher to teach math. Well, I think the problem begins long before they reach the classroom. I think a lot of it is about preparation for children at the moment they reach a classroom, and sometimes the damage has just been done. I don't mean to say those tough cases can't be taught, but they're sure harder to teach.
Well, sure, yeah. And then, I mean, you know, there are schools that bend that curve, I think, with that defy the odds to some extent.
Yeah, but they, nobody's ever replicated it across in any broad way.
I think it's really hard to do.
Well, yeah, it is. And I mean, I sound like I'm saying give up on it, and I'm not saying that, but I think it's always so easy to find a villain, you know, to pick on and say they're failing. And sometimes it's not the teachers at a school that are failing, or the principal, or even the kids. I mean, it's a combination of circumstances. You know, if you have a kid who arrives at school in kindergarten who doesn't know his ABCs, which happens, I mean, they start so far behind.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's just hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to me, the big lesson with poverty and demographics and test scores is just always that it's concentration more than anything else. You know, it's not that a kid from a poor household can't, like, bring their scores up and excel, but if they're trapped in a school in which the poverty rate is 99%, they're just a lot more likely to not be able to overcome.
Right, between, I mean, they come to school hungry, they come to school tired, they come to school with behavioral problems.
Well, it just creates problems. I mean, these, it's the same reason why you have neighborhoods in which poverty is concentrated have these endemic problems, because, they compound each other. And that's why, I mean, integration across socioeconomic lines is so important, because if you can find poor children in a single campus, then you're just creating a recipe for continued poverty.
Well, here's some good news. The kids are going to be safe from now on because the School Safety Commission made its recommendations this week. And about 13th and 14th on the list were some concerns about bullying and about mental health. But number one, Asa Hutchinson, everybody agrees, we've just got to have people with guns in every school campus in Arkansas.
Yeah, so tell me more about that. I don't know much about
that. They say they're not going to create any mandates, that the legislature isn't going to require districts to do anything that's not funded, but they are. I mean, what school district's going to have the gumption to say, no, we're just not going to, Little Rock to say, no, we're not going to hire 48 hired guards. Now they have the suggestions, well, you can get some retired military men, or you can train some of your staff member. Although the governor also said, we're not going to require any school staff member or teacher to carry a gun. It'll only be if they want to.
So armed personnel could be both a school resource officer, like a...
They would prefer a school resource officer, but I think they understand to recommend that as the only solution. There's no city police proportion that's going to fire them, and the Little Rock School District is going to hire 48 qualified law enforcement officers to staff every school. No, so they say there are these other ways you can do it, by volunteer help and stuff, and of course that begins to lower the level of service. And in my point of view, you know, the thought I've had, and of course you can't say this kind of thing anymore except on a podcast, but I don't think, in my 42 years in Arkansas, 46 years in Arkansas, there has been a shooting in a public school. I can remember a shooting on a middle school campus playground.
The Jonesboro?
There was that. But, I mean, that's a school security guard. I mean, they lay in wait on a hillside and pot shot at people when they left the building. I'm talking about the kind of a school invasion where somebody goes into a school building and opens fire.
Okay.
I can't think of a single one. There have been guns that have discharged. There was one killing on the Henderson Middle School playground. I don't think it was during school hours, but it happened. And yeah, the Jonesboro case was terrible, but again, those were kids who pulled a fire alarm and then were lying in ambush to shoot people as they came out of the building. it's hard for me to think of my kids' days in Gibbs Elementary School and Woodruff Elementary School that they'd walk past an armed guard. Of course, when my kids went to school, you could walk in and out of the buildings without being questioned. Now, they all have locked doors. They probably should. You have to sign in an office. There's security cameras everywhere now. I don't know. I'm just one of those ones that doesn't believe guns is necessarily the answer, but it seems we've and the number.
Are you saying that the sort of risk and the calculation of risk is
It's kind of like what's happened with Homeland Security. You know, we've created this $1 trillion security business because of a handful of events, and I mean, was that really worth it? I mean, would we have really had that many events had we not done it? And is, I mean, it's cold to say, but maybe the occasional catastrophe, bad as it would be, doesn't justify all the rest of it and kind of create an armed camp in America. I don't know. It just bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about that with schools, but I mean, with handguns in general, you can definitely make that argument, I think, that just having more guns in people's houses increases the likelihood of homicides and suicides, and that I would counterbalance as any benefit in terms of self-defense.
All right, I mean, there have been occasions of people who've left guns in restrooms. They forget them. They drop out of their pocket. I mean, accidents do happen. Availability of guns has clearly increased the suicide rate because they're more effective than other means of committing suicide. And so I don't know. It's just
I'm not sure.
I mean, I'm on the losing end of it. I'm on the
that or not.
I'm on the losing end of this in Arkansas and perhaps everywhere. But I'm just I'm not a believer that having more people with guns is necessarily making us any safer.
Sure.
So, well, are there any happy topics? No. Well, here's one. Today was a deadline for filing petitions to get on the ballot in November for either constitutional amendments or initiated act. There were only three that were approved by the Attorney General as to form. Mm-hmm. One is about casinos. It would allow casinos in Jefferson and Polk County and formalize the wink, wink, and a nod fake casinos that already exist at Oaklawn and Southland Park. And all the casinos could have sports wagering, which would be a big new thing. The money would go to general revenues. They're kind of pitching it as a potential source of money for highways, but it's not dedicated to that. It'd be left to the legislature. They turned in 96,000 signatures today. Paid canvassers also were gathering signatures on one, a change to term limits. Again, the legislature went back and changed our original term limits amendment, which was 6 years in the House and eight in the Senate, to 16 years. And through a quirk of the law, because the Senate has people who draw two-year terms at times that don't count, Jason Raper right. could serve 22 years in the state Senate. If that's not enough reason to vote for a change, I don't know what is. This proposal by U.S. term limits would change it to 10 years, kind of split the baby in half. And then finally, there's a proposal to raise the minimum wage. That's an initiated act. It needs fewer signatures. It'd raise it from $8.50 to $11 an hour by 2022. And it still haven't said where the money came to do the canvassing. David Couch was the leader of it, but I noticed in a filing today that it's a number of old good government liberals, Rich Huddleston of Arkansas Advocates, Steve Copley of the religious group that works on sort of progressive social issues.
They kind of spearheaded the last...
Kathy Webb, the city director, former legislator, Camille Bennett, former legislator, and just a lot of good folks in there trying to raise the minimum wage. I suspect that the minimum wage effort, to a certain degree, not only because it's a good thing to do, is about putting things on the ballot that might increase turnout and might bring some people from the popular end of the spectrum to the polls in the midterms and perhaps carry an odd Democrat or two across the line, which would be nice. It'll be hard in Arkansas, either at the state legislature or the congressional level for sure, but anything that aids to that I think is a good thing.
You know, so I've always wondered about the minimum wage initiative. Why don't they include some sort of a tie to the, like, why doesn't it rise over time? Why don't they tie it to inflation?
Well, I thought the current thing had a small escalator, but maybe not. I don't know. Well, because I think The only thing I can guess, and actually they ratcheted back the top in this. They'd originally planned 12, and they put it back to 11.
Okay.
Because they thought that was more passable, and that's only in 4 years' time. I think they fear the business lobby coming in and saying there's an open-ended thing, and by 2025 we could be paying $50 an hour or something if there was an inflationary spiral.
Sure.
And I don't know what the, thinking is, but, you know, at $8.50 an hour, we're ahead of a handful of states,
which is kind of remarkable.
Which is kind of remarkable to begin with. So there's that. And so the Secretary of State will now have to go through these petitions and see if they got enough registered voters, and it's yet to be determined. The interesting thing is that no opposition has formed to these yet. Now we're going to see a ton of money spent and some things that the legislature's already put on the ballot. One of them is issue one, the so-called tort reform amendment. This is the one that will put a cap on damage suit awards, put a cap on attorney's fees, and the real Trojan horse in here is the thing that would take rulemaking authority from the Supreme Court and give it to our corrupt legislature, which is just a horrifying thought.
It actually says that in the ballot.
I wish it.
Give it to our corrupt legislature.
I wish it did. I expect if there's any advertising, somebody will be pointing. I'm quite sure the trial lawyers will be pointing out some of the corrupt people that would be put in charge under this proposal. I think there's a chance of a legal challenge of this amendment, by the way. There is a very clear constitutional provision against log rolling, that is, having more than one specific law change in a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court in the past has been very ticky about this on citizen-initiated amendments, less so about those submitted by the legislature. And this Supreme Court does tend to kowtow the legislature, but you have two very clearly different things. One is a limit on damage lawsuits. One changes court rule procedures. Hmm. I mean, they're just totally divergent things. Hmm. I mean, and so I think there's a strong argument that they violated the Constitution in this, but I'm practicing law here without a license, so I do that a lot.
Well, do you see strong opposition, well-funded opposition emerging to the casino amendment with Oakland?
I think Southland is definitely in, and they will be contributing. And to date, Oakland, all the indicators is that they will go along with it. Because it doesn't really, I don't think they view the Pine Bluff Casino as necessarily cutting too terribly into their business. I mean, they are happy that nobody's going to put one in Little Rock. And I mean that would have been more of a direct threat competition wise.
I see.
So I don't know who. Oh, I think the religious lobby, the Family Council, sure, and the Faith and Government Coalition will likely say their normal things about gambling because they're reliably against them. But I don't think they'll have money to spend.
Think it'll pass?
It might. I mean, there's long been a resistance to casino gambling in Arkansas, and the church groups can turn out, but I think this notion of free money that, you know, and bringing tourism and all that kind of stuff, I think it stands a better chance than any of the previous ones I had. Yeah. Minimum wage always polls well. I hope it'll pass.
Yeah. $11 minimum wage in Arkansas would be pretty impressive. I don't wonder how that stacks up to other similarly bottom of the income ladder states.
Yeah, no, that would look pretty good. But there are a lot of business people that don't like that, for sure. So what? Anything else? Christine Baker stood up and protected women's medical rights again late last week, and again issued an injunction against the stupid state law that says abortion clinics have to have a hospital admitting doctor.
So is this a temporary order?
It's temporary, yeah, until a trial, unless the Eighth Circuit reverses it or again. And I mean, we have a law that's been declared unconstitutional in other states and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, but the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is very conservative, and there's just no telling. Oh, and I know the other big news I wanted to mention, you've been following this closely, is medical marijuana scoring. They find, because the Supreme Court overturned Wendell Griffin on the cultivation permit awards, they finally started moving ahead on the dispensary permitting process and had a meeting this week about what they're going to do about that.
Right, yeah. The commission met on Monday, and they made it clear before they weren't going to actually award the cultivation permits, which have been sort of just in cold storage ever since March or so. And the reason they weren't able to do that yet is because there's a 2-week period after the Supreme Court issued its decision, which it could be, someone could ask for a rehearing and, correct me if I have that wrong, but they said that, you know, as of next week, they would be able to move forward with the, awarding those cultivation permits formally if they chose to do so. But in the meantime, yeah, they talked about what to do about all this enormous number of dispensary applications, even, you know, larger than the number of cultivation applications they received. Over 200, I forget the exact number.
And it's for what, 30?
I think it's 32.
32,
maybe.
Yeah.
32 different dispensary licenses. And so, I mean, the interesting thing is that they said, well, maybe we should get an outside consultant to come
and score these things. And they reserve the final decision for themselves.
Correct, right? Yeah. And it's not, I mean, they still haven't even finalized
that. They may not do that
yet. They're going to meet, I think, next week to hear from state procurement about whether or not they could get somebody who has a current contract with the state to do that scoring, whether they'd have to go to the
right. There's a question where they got to get the legislative approval to even do this, but...
Yeah, they're going to have to do some kind of emergency rulemaking.
Enough hell has been raised that they're going to have to get an outsider to look at it. They made such a mess.
You know, I mean, the long and the short of it is that it's been like almost, what, it's been 18 months since the amendment was passed.
And right, it'll be two years in November.
There's nobody has any idea when there could be medical marijuana available for
patients. Right, and it's going to take at least 60 days to grow a crop. And nobody can yet plant seeds.
Right.
So, I mean, there's no telling.
I mean, well, if you're a cultivator, even if they move forward with these incredibly, like, dubious, I guess, decision about who actually received the cultivation awards.
When that happens, there are going to be more losses.
I'm sure there will be.
But the losers are going to challenge some of the awards.
But, I mean, if by some miracle that just, you know, the five... golden applicants were to receive their permit, then you're still not going to grow anything if you don't have a storefront that you can sell it.
Right, unless you got a place to sell it.
Both pieces have to be in place in order for the
Yeah, that's
to
right. I mean, they got to know that's coming before they put something in the ground.
Yeah.
At least have some reasonable expectation of when the dispensary permits are going to be awarded.
Right. So I don't know. You know, I mean, the point is, like, it's still... seems as far away as it did like in November of 2016. And there's also two commissioners that are going to be exiting the commission as of the end of this year.
And some of them might not be missed. Well, gee, I don't know. Is there anything else? My favorite event of the week was a nice turnout Saturday at the rally at the Capitol for Keeping Families Together, a protest of separating families at the border as the Trump administration has done. And, of course, we learned today that there are actually many more children separated than we knew. It's closer to 3,000. The government says it can't meet a judge's order to get them back together in a short period of time. They're doing DNA testing to try and match people up. The government is now saying we're going to see whether these parents are suitable enough to have their kids back. It's just an ongoing nightmare. But my favorite thing was somebody took a shroud down to this rally and placed it over the Ten Commandments monument and put in big letters that thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, kind of emphasized one of the great commandments from the New Testament by Jesus. And needless to say, Jason Raper jumped right into the briar patch and said, there are video cameras about this. We're going to find who defaced that monument. And it just set in mind my idea that, of course, they didn't deface anything. They just put a sheet over it. But that what we ought to do is come up with all kinds of light shows that cast wonderful messages on the Ten Commandment monuments at night. That would, you know, Jason Raper's a jerk or something more inventive than that.
Think but constructively, Max.
Something more inventive than that. But things like, you know, welcome strangers or whatever. I mean, there are many good things you could say. And it wouldn't deface anything. Just take some pictures of them, put them on Facebook every day just to rile up Rayford and them.
That seems doable.
I think we could do that. I think we need to get a guy with one of those projectors. Like, you know, someone that's been throwing up stuff on Trump's hotel in Washington. Some of those things have been kind of good. So I think that's what we need. Well, we've probably yammered on enough here, do you think?
I think so.
Do you have anything to endorse? I've got something to endorse.
Sure. My endorsement is I went to the mountains in Utah.
Oh man!
A few weeks ago.
That sounds
backpacking.
Great.
Yeah, the Uintas. I'd never heard of them before.
I'd never heard of them either.
The largest east-west mountain range in the continental United States, evidently.
They're longer than the Washitas. You know, because the Washitas are an east-west.
That's true.
They're a rare east-west range.
That's true. I think they outdo the Washitas.
I expect they're a little bit bigger.
If you look at some pictures.
The Washitas are kind of hills.
Yeah. Anyway, I spent 2 days out there with a friend of mine. It was wonderful.
Was it cool at night?
It's cold.
Great. Yeah. Sounds wonderful. Sounds good. Well, my endorsement's pretty obvious, but the tomatoes are in and so are the blackberries. And the tomatoes are good. I get mine at the Heights Market because I get some good heirloom quality ones from down in South Arkansas. And, man, it's the great time of the year. The peach is not here yet, but soon, I hope. I hope there are peaches. Sometimes the peach crop fails. But the tomatoes are here, and I've been eating them by the peck. So y'all do that, too.
All right. I guess that wraps us up.
We're done.
We're done.
See y'all next week.